Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. It's a week for biographies. This week, I'll be talking with Tulane University's Thomas Beller, whose new book is J.D. Salinger, The Escape Artist. We'll also hear from Michael S. Martin of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette's Center for Louisiana Studies. His new biography is Russell Long, A Life in Politics. Thomas Beller is an associate professor of English at Tulane University. He's the author of the story collection Seduction Theory, the novel The Sleepover Artist, and a memoir, How to Be a Man, Scenes from a Protracted Boyhood. He's also the co-founder of the literary journal Open City. Today, we'll be talking about his new book, J.D. Salinger, The Escape Artist. Tom, welcome to The Reading Life.
Nice to be here, Susan.
We all have such a fascination with J.D. Salinger, and you made writing this biography sound like such an adventure. It certainly took you to some interesting places.
Well, it took me to interesting places geographically and historically and personally.
So tell us about some of those geographical places to start with.
I have to begin by saying that Salinger's childhood and young adulthood took place in Manhattan, and so did mine. Salinger's relationship to the sort of ancestral Salinger apartment, the apartment that he spent most of his childhood, was kind of prolonged. Even though he served in World War II and saw very serious action, he was in and out of that apartment as his primary residence fairly well into his 20s. In fact, I feel that Salinger was a sort of forerunner of many trends in American culture, ranging from issues around food, spirituality, anxieties about the media industrial complex, and you might potentially add to that list an early not leaving the nest type of kids who never leave. But that's maybe a bit glib since he did go fight very seriously in World War II, but then he came back and lived with his parents. So all of this took place physically in terrain that I was very familiar with, except by the time I started the book, I was living in New Orleans. One of the big ironies of the book for me was I found myself running up to New York from New Orleans to linger in this landscape that I was familiar with from my own life, because I've only moved down to New Orleans in 2008 and I'd lived in New York until then, and trying to imagine it also as it existed when he was a kid, which was in the 20s and 30s. And there was a point where I became a bit exasperated about the fact I was in New Orleans writing about my hometown, my subjects, not just hometown, but the sort of locus of all of his fiction where it was set, thinking, this is crazy. What am I doing in New Orleans? This is like a fate's joke on me. And then the finale of that scenario was that one of my big discoveries had to do with an editor that was so important to Salinger, Gus Lebrano. And that itself was a bit of an ordeal or a process to gain the trust of his daughter and start learning some things about that relationship. And at the very end of writing the book, the daughter mentioned almost in passing that, you know, Lebrano was from New Orleans. Mm-hmm. And this, in turn, led to a discovery that he had graduated from Newman High School in 1919, and the archivist at Newman provided me with all these yearbook material and so forth. So my subject had as one of his most important figures a New Orleans native who went to school about 8 or 10 blocks from where I live.
So full circle. That happens so often. But you even went to Salinger summer camp.
Yeah, that was very rewarding. I mean, my feeling about all this was that, you know, landscape is very important to Salinger. Mm-hmm. And that includes, you know, terrain of the prep school and the Catcher in the Rye, Manhattan throughout. Apartments and the atmosphere of a particular kind of apartment seemed very important. And I felt it would be useful to situate myself in some of the places that were important to him. So I feel anyone who spent any time in Manhattan can de facto claim to have been to Salinger country, so to speak. But this business of summer camp seemed suggestive to me because obviously kids are so prominent in his fiction. And the notion of some pastoral setting in the woods up there is also very important to him. So I wanted to get a glimpse, and it was quite suggestive, really.
Oh, summer camp in Maine. It doesn't get much better, I don't think.
I'd never been to Maine before. I As I mentioned in the book, I was really struck by the two billboards one encounters when you enter the state. The first is a huge billboard saying, life as it should be lived, and the second is a slightly smaller one stressing the severe penalties for drunk driving in a way that suggests that they're levied frequently.
Now, you feel a strong connection with Salinger and his work, don't you?
Well, yes and no. Yes, in the sense that I suspect many people feel connected with Salinger because we just often, many people encounter him at a fairly young age. So you read Catcher in the Rye, 8th, 9th, 10th grade.
Well, and let's talk about the 8th grade canon.
Yeah.
I really love that.
Thank you. There's a chapter in the book that is specifically about the teacher I had in 8th grade. It was this pretty eccentric and inspiring character. And his 8th grade canon had a few, I suspect, anomalies. On the Road was one of them. Mm-hmm. But the core of the 8th grade canon, I feel, is something like 1984 by Orwell, A Separate Piece, To Kill a Mockingbird, Lord of the Flies, Catcher in the Rye, with some addendums and so forth surrounding that, On the Road in this guy's case. So apropos of you asking me about my connection with Salinger, it's powerful because I read him as a young person, and when I kind of returned to him, I discovered this other part of Salinger beyond The Catcher in the Rye, the stories and all the Glass family stuff. But coming back to him again, it's not just a purely literary experience. It sort of reaches back into this pretty formative moment of one's own life as a reader. But that said, I'm not without criticism of Salinger. And when I was talking to people, I was very clear that I wasn't some kind of partisan. Right. If people said they found Salinger boring or overrated, I had no problem with that and was interested to hear some very interesting, credible people had that opinion, maybe most notably Robert Gottlieb, who for a period of years edited The New Yorker, an extremely notable editor, and he just said that he never saw what the fuss was about.
Mm-hmm. And you had access to some really amazing material writing this book. And one of those was Ian Hamilton's unexpurgated biography.
Yes.
As a book person, that thrilled me no end for you.
Well, I felt like the fact that Salinger is famous for many reasons that are sort of beyond the reasons he should be famous for.
Right.
And one of those meta reasons is his insistence on privacy and the way that he pursued protecting his privacy, you know, in the courts. And there was this enormously scandalous and sensational trial that involved his suing Random House and Ian Hamilton, this author, that they were publishing over a book that he'd assembled. And he had really not played by the rules. These letters were in university collections, and he signed releases saying he'll only use them if he gets permission. He proceeded to use them without permission. And I think the bet was that the First Amendment would trump all other considerations. And to everyone's surprise, that turned out not to be the case. Random House won the first round. Salinger appealed it, and he won the appeal, and the Supreme Court declined to hear the case, and he won. So that just seemed like such a explicitly formidable barrier to entry dealing with Salinger as a subject. And I felt even though he died by the time I took the book on, I had to talk about and think through this problem that my subject had made not being written about one of his greatest stated priorities.
So you find this kind individual who's letting you borrow one of the few copies of this book and tells you, don't lose it.
Yeah.
And you proceed to do that.
In a way.
In a way. So I wonder if you'd read that brief little chapter, Lost, for us.
Lost. I wander out into the early evening on 77th Street and bike 10 blocks home, where I put the book in a special place. But it's not quite right to use the word home. I bike to my mother's apartment, where I grew up, and where my family and I now camp out for extended stays when we visit New York. It is summer. Summers used to last longer, I feel. Now I hardly get to the halfway point before it starts to feel like I'm getting ready to decamp back to New Orleans, where I teach at Tulane University. But that evening, with my newly won prize, I feel there is time. Time to savor the city. Time to contemplate Salinger. Time to read the book in which J.D. Salinger's pilfered words, which he had written in the late 1930s, 1940s, and beyond, with every expectation that they would be seen by their recipient alone, were now available to me. The book was by Ian Hamilton, but the anticipated pleasure was reading J.D. Salinger. A week goes by, then another, then another. The Ian Hamilton galley blinks out at me from its special place. I don't read it, but I take comfort in knowing where it is. My family and I make the move to New Orleans, and eventually, when we are unpacked, it occurs to me that I haven't seen that lemon drop yellow book in a while. A search ensues. I assume it is at my mother's, but when I next visit New York, it is not in the special place. I have a dim recollection of moving it from the special place to an even more special place. I search for it, but it is in no place. I've lost the book. I am totally stricken at my inability to locate my galley of Ian Hamilton's J.D. Salinger, A Writing Life. This is not wildly out of character for me. I almost turned it down when its owner held it out towards me so lovingly, a tattered and delicate thing. Almost immediately, once the full panic sets in, I'm confronted with the metaphor of the circumstance. In so much of Salinger's work, there is a nearly pathological emphasis on privacy. I do not mean the famous hermetic privacy to which the man retreated in life, but rather the sense of privacy that permeates the fiction. Really, I thought, trying to calm myself about the loss of J.D. Salinger, A Writing Life, it's impossible to even contemplate writing a biography of Salinger without getting into the issues of privacy, secrecy, intimacy, and by extension, betrayal. To read this suppressed book would be a theft. But I thought, surely the author's death changes things. The change is legal, physical, and moral. It involves permission, that which you must acquire and that which you can, in good conscience, grant yourself. In some ways, this basic fact that death changes things is the burning ember that sits at the center of Salinger's fiction. I suppose this book can be framed as, among other things, a quest to find out why this is the case, that the process might involve thrusting my hand into a coat pocket and yanking out a letter is unpleasant to contemplate. I have to remind myself that the owner's hand is no longer there. The hand, literally Salinger's hand, is gone, but the letters, the fiction, the voice, and the curiosity to know how that voice came into being remain.
I've had that feeling so many times. The one book I needed, not there, not in the place, the special place. So how do you feel about him now? Are there any mysteries left about him for you? If you could meet him, what would you ask him?
I don't actually crave that or wish to have the opportunity to meet him. The person I'm a little bit curious about is his son, Matthew Salinger, because he's in an interesting situation where he's clearly been given a mandate, explicitly or implicitly, I don't know, to continue with this sense of protection of the Salinger estate. There's the sense that there are some instructions and obviously a body of work that's at some point going to come out. And it's on the son's shoulders to kind of carry forward the father's work, which is probably true of all literary heirs. But for the son, as was the case with the author, you know, there's almost two stories. One is the story of how this writer developed as a person, as a kid, how they developed a voice, how they broke through as a writer, the arc of their career, how they wrote the work they did, the meaning of that work, how it echoes with their life. And then in Salinger's case, there's this whole other story, which in a funny way, I feel, has come to dominate the discussion inappropriately, which is all about a slightly overblown sense of mystery or almost tabloid sensational drama, curiosity. What's he doing? Why is he hiding? What does he have to hide? So the son has kind of been granted the task of shepherding both of those legacies. But that's the person I would actually be more curious to talk about.
We've been talking with Tom Beller from Tulane University, whose new book is J.D. Salinger, The Escape Artist. You can meet him Friday, May 23rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you, Susan.
Michael S. Martin is a professor of history and director of the Center for Louisiana Studies at the University of Louisiana at Lafayette. He's also the managing editor for the scholarly journal Louisiana History. He's here today to talk about his new book, Russell Long, A Life in Politics. Welcome to The Reading Life, Michael.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Now, here in Louisiana, we just never grow tired of the Long family, do we?
There is an endless amount of stories and history to be talked about when it comes to the Long family and all of its various branches.
And yet Russell's been the least explored one, hasn't he? So tell us about the beginning of this book and what held your interest about him through the writing of it.
Well, the book started, as I think many books do, in a conversation. I was discussing with one of my colleagues how fascinating the Long family is, but how so much had already been written on Earl and Huey. And the colleague responded, yeah, but not much has been done on Russell. So at that point, I realized that's true, despite the fact that Russell had this very long career in the United States Senate, was enormously influential in terms of national politics as opposed to Louisiana politics. He was influential here as well. And that got my mind to thinking that perhaps it would be something that I could write on. From beginning to end, the project took about 12 years to complete, partly because Long's career was so long that he left an extensive paper trail that takes up thousands of shelf feet on library shelves. So I had to spend a lot of time digging around in archives, doing research, and trying to piece together the essential elements of his political life. And then, of course, the writing and revising and all takes a while as well. What kept my interest always was the fact that Russell, even though he's not as flamboyant and he's not as maybe even famous as his father and his uncle were, Russell, I think, had this tremendous influence on our nation's political life. And it's an influence that has been largely not ignored, but simply not discussed.
Mm. Now, one of the things you brought home so beautifully in this book was how very difficult it was to be Huey Long's son.
As I suspect many of your listeners would imagine, to be the son of someone who was quite possibly the most famous person from this state ever, and to be the son of someone who was so polarizing, both inside the state and out, people weren't wishy-washy about Huey. They either loved him or hated him. And that, on the one hand, created a great sense of hope when people looked at Russell. You know, here's the person who can carry on for his deceased father. On the other hand, for the people who really despised Huey Long, Russell, simply by the fact of his birth, became an enemy.
And Huey changed Russell's name.
Well, initially, Huey's wife, Rose Long, had decided to name Russell, or the boy who would become Russell, Huey III. Huey was actually a junior, although he never used that in his name. Huey, immediately upon hearing that, said, no, we can't burden him with my name. One, because I don't want him to have to deal with what I expect will come from my political career, which will be this polarization. I mean, this was actually before Huey had held a single office, but he realized what kind of personality he had and what his political career quite likely might lead to. So he didn't want to burden his son with that. Also, he thought it was kind of unfair to be known as Little Huey, or, you know, to be thought of as this kind of second tier or something like that. And that was something he had experienced as Huey, or the second, I would say.
Now, one of the things that fascinated me was you write about the effect that T. Harry Williams' masterful biography of Huey Long had on Russell, and that it had this interesting twofold effect for him. Would you talk about that a bit? Because that's a book that so many Louisianans have read, and this is really an interesting thing to me.
Well, Russell, because he was still a teenager when Huey died, and even before then, Huey was largely absent from Russell's life. Russell had, as you might suspect, when you lose a father so young, you come to revere the memory of that man. And so Russell had, even from his teenage years, had always been a defender of his father's legacy. But he had to do that against reports by the news media and then later academic works that basically vilified Huey Long, that showed Huey to be this demagogue and this destroyer of democracy in Louisiana and this real threat to the nation's political system. So Russell was combating that, and he was basically combating that on his own. When he heard that T. Harry Williams was working on a biography of his father, he got in touch with Williams, and they developed this kind of working relationship where Russell would kind of open doors for Williams as he was doing research. Russell and his family actually put forth some funds to pay for some of the research and writing the time off that T. Harry Williams was going to need from LSU to do that. And they developed this very close working relationship. When the book was published, and eventually it won the Pulitzer Prize, phenomenally well-written book, it portrayed Huey Long in a rather positive light. Basically, Williams said these earlier historians and these members of the media who portrayed him as, you know, almost demonic in character, got him all wrong. They misunderstood his motivations. They misunderstood what he was trying to do. And for Russell, as you said, there was this twofold effect. One, T. Harry Williams uncovered a lot of the facts of Huey Long's life that Russell himself never knew, mainly because while Russell was growing up and in high school, his father was either in Baton Rouge at the state capitol or off in Washington, D.C., or going across Louisiana or the nation politicking. so Russell really didn't know his father that well. But then secondly, what T. Harry Williams' book provided for Russell was a sort of affirmation that when Russell would go out and say, look, my father really wasn't as bad as everybody said he was, what he was doing was good for the people of Louisiana and potentially good for the people of the nation, now he had this bona fide academic historian supporting him on
right.
that level.
He had backup.
That's right.
Now, talk a little bit for us about Russell's long public life. I mean, he wasn't always successful in his involvement with Louisiana politics at home, but he was involved in some of the major issues of his time.
That's right. So he entered the United States Senate in 1948. He was the youngest member of the Senate at that point. He retired in very early 1987. And that time period encompasses some of the major developments of national life in the United States. It's a time period that encompasses the Civil Rights Movement. It encompasses the Cold War. I mean, practically from beginning to end, his career matches up pretty closely with the Cold War. Mm-hmm. And those are things that through his membership on, for instance, the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, he was able to foster the responses and the activities of the United States in the Cold War. Now, he was a member of that committee, never chair, as chair of the Senate Finance Committee from the 1960s through 1980. He was able to oversee the implementation of much of the social legislation of the so-called Great Society under Lyndon Johnson. He was able to influence American taxation policy to a degree that I don't think anybody before or since has been able to influence American taxation. And he's able to exert a tremendous amount of influence over not just his committee, but the Senate as a whole. There was also a time in from the mid-60s, from about 65 up until 1969, where he served as Democratic Majority Whip, which meant that in addition to his committee membership and chairmanship obligations, he was ushering through legislation on the floor of the United States Senate. And so he is the person who, at the floor level, is involved with getting most of the Great Society legislation passed and so forth. Now, as a member of the so-called Southern Bloc, Russell Long opposed every piece of civil rights legislation that came before him during his tenure in the Senate. So he was just like every other Southern senator who expected that their career would last past the next election. He stood in opposition to the major civil rights acts of, in particular, 64, the Voting Rights Act of 65, but there were numerous others in the late 60s and even some before that in the late 50s and early 60s that he was an obstructionist when you get right down to it.
Mm-hmm. Now, I've heard lots of biographers talk about their relationships with their subjects, and you have to find something really compelling about a person to spend 12 years with them. So what were your points of connection and disconnection with Russell Long?
Well, to start with, having grown up in Louisiana, I grew up partly in Lafayette, partly in New Orleans. Everywhere you look, there's something with the name Long on it. Huey P. Long Bridge,
right.
Earl, you know, everywhere you turn around, there's something that reminds you of these people. Maybe not so much Russell, but the family itself was kind of ingrained in my mind at a very early age. And then as I got older, you know, discussing with older family members about the Longs and so forth, hearing the sometimes entertaining and other times kind of disconcerting stories of the Long family, that's what first attracted me to the Longs. Then the realization that, as I said earlier, so much had been written on Huey and Earl, and which is not to say that more couldn't be said, but realizing that not much had been written on Russell himself kind of opened the door. And then, you know, these 12 years, what's really driven me has been this kind of fascination with a politician who can, and this seems very foreign in today's, in our contemporary political situation, a politician who can be conservative on the one hand and liberal on the other and not have a problem with being both, right? So he's very conservative when it comes to race relations. And that's something that I find in some ways repulsive. On the other hand, he's very liberal when it comes to things like social welfare legislation, when it comes to things like fiscal or taxation policy. He's just as liberal as senators from Illinois or New York and places like that. Today, it seems like you have to be one or the other. You can't say, oh, I'm conservative, but I also have these liberal tendencies. That's not going to fly, it seems, in Washington today. So I think over time, as I kind of came to understand Russell's political philosophy, I realized that there is a different way of doing things. And although I am no politician and I will never be a politician, I think it's important for voters, politicians, for just kind of general citizens to be aware that there are other options, there are other ways of doing things.
Right. Well, we've been talking with Michael S. Martin of the University of Louisiana at Lafayette, whose fascinating new book is Russell Long, A Life in Politics. Michael, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Robert Simonson discusses and signs The Old-Fashioned, the story of the world's first classic cocktail with recipes and lore. Tuesday, May 20th at 5:30 at Cane and Table, 1113 Decatur. Eve O. Schaub signs A Year of No Sugar, a memoir. Tuesday, May 20th at 6 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. Today's guest, Thomas Beller, discusses and signs J.D. Salinger, The Escape Artist, Friday, May 23rd at 6 at Octavia Books. Artist Mel Chin appears with writer Rebecca Solnit to discuss Lead and Lies from Unfathomable City, a New Orleans Atlas, Friday, May 23rd at 6 at the New Orleans Museum of Art. New Orleans Recreation Development Commission, NORD, sponsors a Local Authors Book Fest, Saturday, May 24th from 11 to 2 at Joe Brown Park, 5601 Reed Boulevard. The event will feature readings from Veronica Brown and Mona Lisa Saloy, and guests will be able to meet authors Clarence Nero, Anaya Kaye, Monique Moliere-Piper, Khalif Aziz, Wendy Russo, Shaletta Matthews, Christian David Atwood, Debbie Nat Jones, and more. There will also be book giveaways. Regina Charbonneau signs Mississippi Current Cookbook, A Culinary Journey Down America's Greatest River, Saturday, May 24th at 1 p.m. at Garden District Bookshop. Barbara Herman signs Scent and Subversion, Decoding a Century of Provocative Perfume, Tuesday, May 27th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. And here's something new on the literary calendar this year. St. Francisville will host a Walker Percy weekend June 6th through 8th. The events include a screening of Win Riley's documentary about Percy, panel discussions, tours of Angola and the Entergy nuclear power plant, as well as one event Percy would have loved, a progressive front porch bourbon tour. That's Saturday night. And of course, it will be followed by Mass on Sunday morning. For more information, check out walkerpercyweekend.org. Congrats are in order to writer Maurice Ruffin. The attorney's local story, The Ones Who Don't Say They Love You, was selected for the 2014 Iowa Review Award, judged by novelist Rachel Kushner. This will be published in the winter issue, and Ruffin's story, The Anchor Song, won the 2014 So to Speak contest, judged by Charles Blackstone. It will appear in the fall issue. And two organizations have received funding for Big Read projects. The Southern Food and Beverage Museum will present a Big Read for John Steinbeck's The Grapes of Wrath, and the Pirates Alley Faulkner Society received funding for Denham and Guestue's The Beautiful Things That Heaven Bears. More to come about these projects. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading. ¶¶